It's my pleasure this morning to introduce our speaker, Jennifer Anderson. She has been interested in the night sky since childhood. Lying on her back on a picnic table, she would learn her way around the night sky using paper maps. She built her first telescope and read Carl Sagan at the age of 12. She studied astrophysics and eventually decided on planetary geology. In her talk this morning, Jennifer Anderson will explore a little about the science of the moon and think about our place in our universe, all its atoms and its life forms over 13.7 billion years of time.
All right. So the last thing I did before I left my house this morning was change the title of my talk. It is an old view of our moon I'm going to talk about. It's very old. It's our human view of the moon, and I feel very close to it. And then I didn't know I had to give you a talk title like 6 weeks ago, and I said, well, I don't know, spiritual understanding. And then I've been working on this talk, and I went, I don't understand. So now this is my spiritual connection to our universe, okay? Yeah, I don't understand, but I joined you all last week for Eric Nelson's talk about birds and fish and nature, and he could not, I am so grateful, he couldn't have set me up better. It really inspired me for how I was going to try and shape what I'm going to talk to you about today. So there's our bar-tailed godwit, and I think if I get this right, Eric, I don't know where he is, but, oh, there you are, 18,000 miles round trip? Right? 10,000 from Alaska, where it breeds, all the way to New Zealand without stopping. Something like 8 days. What is this bird, a pound and a half or something like that, right? Maybe half a pound when it gets there. Okay. So I, of course, am a scientist, and I went, wait a second. Like, how does that bird know how to get to New Zealand? I can't go to New Zealand. You can't drop me in the middle of somewhere and get me somewhere. I could probably do okay, but not to New Zealand. And I looked it up, and it turns out there's a great Scientific American article just about this bird, or one of the many examples of birds that do this, and they talk about how migrating birds use quantum effects within these little magnetometers in their heads, and they use the Earth's magnetic field, and that's how this tiny little bird gets there. And I don't know why. I don't remember, Eric, if this was the bird that you mentioned where the adults leave first, and then the babies follow. And you go, how do the babies know how they got there, right? These are scientific questions, and I'm a scientist. Birds, apparently, and many other organisms, as we know, have a weird, only moderately understood, but deeply ingrained connection to the Earth and the universe, and so do I. So I'm like a bird who can talk, I guess. I'm also really pleased to be here speaking to the Unitarian Universalists. I really love this. These are the things that kind of call out to me. It's all of the text is written on the back of your programs, the main text, but principle number 4, a free and responsible search for truth. As a scientist, that's what we're trying to find. We never know if we're right. We don't know if we get there. Meaning, that's a little different. I don't know what it means. That's where I don't understand things. But I love this. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence. I'm going to take, hopefully, what Eric did to connect us, as we all know and feel, to our planet, and I want to connect you to your universe today in the same way. Experience, direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder. So I'm going to talk to you about science, but I want you to be thinking about mystery and wonder. As a scientist, I'll show you where I normally stop talking, which is about what we know, and then we wonder beyond that. Humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science. I like that. I like that our brain is able to understand anything at all. 3 pounds of gray goo between my ears, and we've all worked for how many, 2 million years of evolution or whatever you want to say, and we have figured things out. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life. and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. I love that too. I'm just going to notice for Lee, it seems like this has gotten dark, and I don't know why. I don't know if that's bothering anyone or if it's fine. We'll keep going. So I'm really happy to be here and that to have this kind of framework for how to think. This is a quote from Carl Sagan, and this is not the last time you'll hear me talk about him. But he said a lot of really brilliant things, and he was a brilliant scientist and one of my mentors in the 1980s, right? The original cosmos. I mean, yeah, I love Neil deGrasse Tyson, but there's nobody like Carl Sagan. No offense, Neil. Be the best I can do. Okay, so he says, every kid starts out as a natural-born scientist, and then we beat it out of them. A few trickle through the system with their wonder and enthusiasm for science intact. We do. I'm the geoscience education specialist at Winona State University, and I have spent 20 years trying to break teachers from telling students that science is about the right answer. Science is not about the right answer. It's about not knowing an answer and using our brains to try and figure it out. And that mystery is the part that makes it fun. If I drop this and it falls to the ground, nobody cares. But if I let go and it flies that way, we're all really interested in what just happened, right? And so I want to take a minute and thank my mom. That's my mom. She's here today. This is my grandma, Grandma Esther. That's my mom, Lynn. This is my master's graduation in 2001. And my mom did a great job as a mom not closing the door on my curiosity. And that's why I'm still here asking questions. Because scientists are just four-year-olds who never were told long enough and hard enough to sit down and shut up and stop asking questions. Right? We get dirty, we dig in things, we go and we look at birds and we wonder and we write it all down and we're scientists, right? And that is human nature, I think. We are born to do this. And so I am really happy that my mom raised me in a way that allowed me, oh, now I've really messed up, okay, that allowed me to still be asking questions. So this might be a little, I tried to find a picture of me with a telescope, but it's at night, so I don't have any. But that maybe that's what I looked like, and there's the love that I have for my mom and my family. Okay, so one of the things I did when I was in college, I took an education class on the history of American education, and I did a project where I looked at three important stages of science education in the history of the United States. One was the Committee of Ten. In 1892, I read their original documents. This is what set up the idea that in school you have four sciences you study, and you study Latin and Greek and all the classics and that kind of stuff. So a bunch of old dead white guys told us how to run our high schools, and we're kind of still running our high schools that way. But this is the original way that they organized math and science. It's not what was decided to be done with high schools, which is interesting because high schools turned this upside down. But they said math is at the bottom, then physics, then chemistry, then biology and life, geology and life science up here. I tell this to my students because they say, why do I have to take a chemistry class? And I go, well, because you can't be a geologist without knowing about chemistry, physics, and math. You can be a chemist without knowing anything about the earth. That's not a problem. But this is the foundation of our sciences. Now I've modified it to put astronomy on there. And I, you know, geology is technically earth and space science. There's a lot of stuff. But, you know, if you think about it, math is the language of science, physics is kind of the rules of science, chemistry is kind of what makes up stuff. It's atoms and how they react with each other, which builds everything that we see. And then geology and biology and astronomy is all the gooey stuff that happens. It's all interconnected. It's interesting that it gets small up here because, of course, astronomy is enormous. And astronomy is actually the basis of this triangle, too, because it's what humans tried to figure out. It's the oldest science. And it's what they tried to figure out that created math and physics and chemistry, was our need to understand what was going on in the night sky. Ooh, this is the part that I don't talk about in class. This is the part that you all talk about. I joke, right? Well, what is the number two? How do we know? 1 + 1 = 2. What does that mean? I assume that's a philosopher's job, not my job. But also, this is where the mystery and the wonder and the meaning is, because if we started with astronomy to figure out where we are, and this is what we've come up with, we go, okay, what should I do? And that's not a scientific question anymore, right? What does it mean? lots of ideas. So this is where I want us to sit a little bit while I tell you a little bit about this. So I'm telling you a little bit about how my brain works. And I've been basically an astronomer since, I don't know, Mom, fifth grade, when Mrs. Erdman told me everything I needed to know, and I spent much of the year telling my mom that Mrs. Erdman says something else. And Mrs. Erdman, Mrs. Erdman, my science teacher. But I've spent, you know, now, I don't even want to add up, 45 years becoming a scientist, doing all the things that I need to do to be at a university and teach science. And so I want to tell you a little bit more about how my brain works, how geologists and astronomers in general learn to think about our universe, because it's different than normal people. We think from at many, many scales. So I'll talk about atoms. We build rocks and mountains out of those atoms. Those rocks and mountains form planets. Those planets are one of many in a solar system, which is one of hundreds of millions in our galaxy, which is one of hundreds of billions of galaxies, right? And that is very fluent for me to go back and forth between those scales. We also think about long time periods. You know, people think the dinosaurs were a long time ago. They weren't. Just 65 million years ago, it wasn't that long, right? But my timeline, and this is a very human-centric timeline. Look at this. There's the Big Bang. There's the first stars. There's the Milky Way galaxy. Here's the formation of Earth, origin of life. And then life. That's not how it went. I think Carl Sagan did this initially. He called it the cosmic calendar. And so if you take all of 13.7 billion years of the universe's history since the moment of the Big Bang to present day, and you make the Big Bang happen on January 1st, for 4 months, there's not even a Milky Way galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy showed up on the stage in May. And there sure wasn't our star or our planet. We got here in September. What's interesting is our solar system formed here. We know this very well. I'm going to tell you about old things. So I want to pass around some old things. Please be careful with these. If you drop the heavy one, it'll hurt your foot. If you drop the light one, it might break. These are rocks from space. And I'll have them up front so you can take a closer look. This is like the light-colored one that looks like concrete is the raw ingredients to form the solar system. Everything you need to make a sun and a planet, all the atoms and the elements are in here. The iron, which is the heavy one, so please be gentle with that one. The iron one is a sample from the core of a planet that formed a little tiny planet, a planetesimal that formed out in the asteroid belt and then broke into pieces. So that's what the core of our Earth looks like, our iron core. Those four samples that you're holding are 4,567,000,000 years old. They are older than any rock on our planet. So the solar system shows up in September. We start making asteroids. We start making planets. And life showed up right away after that, actually, really quickly. By October, life, these little organisms figured out photosynthesis, and we started building up an oxygen-rich atmosphere. Our cells got more complicated. Then we get into December. On December 14th, the Cambrian explosion. 543 million years ago, we got snails. Right? December 20th, plants move on to land. Prior to that, the land looked like Mars today. No plants. On the 25th, dinosaurs evolved. On the 26th, mammals evolved. We were snack size and tasty. On the 30th, 5 days later, the dinosaurs go extinct. That was 66 million years ago. That was nothing. December 31st, 12 minutes before midnight, Homo erectus evolves and stands upright. What is that? 46 seconds ago, humans migrated to the Americas during the last glacial ice age. And 1 second ago, Europeans came to the Americas. I told you it's a big place. And this is I've learned how to think this way, right? Like some people know how an internal combustion engine works. I do not. Okay, but I understand this. But I want to talk about the moon a little bit. I'll do my best. I have my moon here. This is my son's moonie. He'll help. I do love the moon. I'm not actually going to talk about the moon as much as I thought, but I love the moon. So here we are looking out at the sky. That's the moon. It's actually a crescent moon, but the sun is right down here. It just set, and you know how you can sometimes, during a crescent, you can see the earth shine. You can see the reflection of the sunlight off the earth that then illuminates the dark part of the moon. This is Venus. It's hard to see here, but there's Orion right here. This is what we saw when humans evolved, right? This is what I saw when I was a kid, and I laid on that picnic table, and I looked up, and I said, what is that? What is that? And that's a scientific question that our human brains can try to answer. Humans have had a long history with the moon, with the sky. If you look back into indigenous cultures from around our globe, they have stories about what they see. Some of my favorite stories, I don't know how to find the man in the moon. I don't know where it is. The Chinese have the rabbit in the moon, Chang'e, or Changa. Bunny head, bunny nose, body, body, legs, legs, tail, ears, leg, leg, hopping that way. That's the rabbit, Chang'e. This way, if you're in parts of China, depending on how it rises, you can see these as the ears. I'll show you that in a second. But so you see that again, rabbit head, nose, ears, body, leg, leg, tail, leg, leg. That's the one I see most easiest, because this is what it looks like. This is the orientation that the moon has a lot from the northern hemisphere. Here's a couple different examples of bunnies, rabbits, that different groups of people see in the moon. There's a lot of them, way better than the man in the moon. The Japanese have an amazing story about the moon child, whose name I think is Kaguya. Interestingly enough, the Chinese space program to the moon is named after Chang'e, the rabbit on the moon, and the Kaguya mission to the moon from Japan is also named after their moon goddess. So here she's looking this way. Her eye would be over here. This is her nose and her mouth. She's a big bouffant hairdo and a beautiful necklace, right? Humans have a connection with this. Native American traditions in North America, and I'm still learning about this, but I found this book called 13 Moons on Turtle's Back, and I said, that's ridiculous. That what? 13 moons? 13 big shell pieces on the moon, on the turtle? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. All turtles have 13 major scutes. They have 28 around the outside, 28 lunar days. Now, I'm not blaming the moon for that, but what an interesting observation and what an interesting connection. This is an example from Oneida. They have the 13 different moons of the year. There are 13 full moons in a year, and a lot of our North American indigenous peoples keep time by those 13 months. So this is an Anishinaabe calendar. The Aztecs kept time as well. Remember in 2012 when we were all going to die because the Aztec calendar was going to come to zero? Nobody bought my amulets. I was going to say, oh my gosh, this is so silly to base your calendar on Venus, and what are they going to do? And we count down until we get to zero at the end of our calendar, right? And then we have a big party and we just start over again. So I wasn't worried about anything happening when the Aztec calendar ended. But we have 13, we have 12 months, roughly 28 days, a month, a month, right? Our year is defined by the Earth's path around the sun in 365 days. Our months, our moons, generally 28 days, and then this Julius Caesar guy got in there. Our days are the Earth's rotation on its axis, and 7 days in the week, if I do it in Spanish, lunes, Monday, moon day, martes, Mars day. Oh, now I'm going to get bad. Lunes, martes, miércoles, mercury, jueves, Jupiter, Jove, jueves, viernes, Venus, Saturn day. Okay, that's the English one. Lunes, martes, viernes, sábado. Y domingo in Spanish is different, but Sunday. So we have Saturn Day, Sun Day, and Moon Day, and the other 4 days were named after the other four visible planets. You got it. Okay, so what is that? Well, you can see the Earthshine. It's our dance partner in space. And so humans started asking questions. We talked about what we saw here. We told stories with each other. We counted our days. Why does it do that? Okay, that's a scientific question. We can answer that. We had to answer this by inventing math and physics, but we did answer it. Okay, we know how that the Earth goes around the Sun and the Moon goes around the Earth. Where is it? Let's say I have a 9-inch diameter Earth. Right here. This is Earthy. Okay. The Moon is 2.5 inches in diameter. Okay, roughly this. 22 feet away, back there somewhere. That's the actual scale. That's the farthest humans have ever traveled away from their planet. Took us 3 days at the fastest speeds we've ever traveled at. Pretty crazy, huh? We did that. Sun is 75 feet in diameter, and it's about 1.5 miles from here. So that's where it is. That's where we are. Not to scale. We won't take a 1.5 mile walk, but if you do, look for birds. We are here. This is a picture of the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the next closest largest galaxy to us, the next large galaxy in our part of the universe. We're about halfway out on the spiral arms. This is about 30,000 light years to the center of our galaxy, and the center of our galaxy has a black hole in it. What that means is when we observe the stars at the center of our galaxy, those photons have been traveling for 30,000 years to get to us. When those photons left those stars in the center of our galaxy, there was a mile of ice just north of us during the last ice age. Okay. What are we made of? Okay, Carl Sagan. I love this picture of him, but it's wrong for me to put up a picture that doesn't look like 1970s and 80s. Carl Sagan. He said, "The cosmos is within us. We are made of star stuff. We are a way for the universe to know itself." Right? So he's talking about the periodic table, which is like the worst table in the whole world, so we're going to talk about it. What are we made of? The Big Bang made hydrogen and helium, these two atoms. Small stars like our sun will make carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, neon. Our star will only make up to carbon. But there's carbon in my body. I'm a carbon-based life form. That means that lots of stars lived and died here in this part of the Milky Way before September when my planet showed up. Large stars are going to die. They're going to make all sorts of elements. Supernovas are going to make all the rest. Humans made a couple, but they don't exist in nature. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna just show you this real quick. Where did the moon come from? This is my husband's video. This is what he does. But the Earth was hit by an object and it spun out a disk of material and our moon formed from that. That's where our moon came from. This is 48 hours into that simulation. So it was kind of this cosmic accident that we have the moon to look at. Can we touch it? Yes. Yeah, we did. We did. And I think I'm just going to leave this up here. This is the Earthrise photo. That's all of us right here, all of us who have ever lived, except for three people who are taking the picture in 1968. This photo was taken in 1972, and we've got everybody who ever lived and whoever will live. Oh, this was Apollo 11, sorry. We've got Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in here. And then who took the picture, does anyone know? Who was the third one who took them all back, who waited? Michael Collins, good job. Michael Collins, he's the only human who's not in this photo. And so, you know, I don't know, what does all that mean? That's what I understand. I think it means we're all connected, we're all the same atoms, we were all made in stars. And we should think of ourselves in that way. That's how I think about the world, is that we're all connected to each other. But it's a lot of wonder and mystery. So I guess that's what I wanted to share with you today. Thanks.
For the last